Hello, I'm John Cork of the Ian Fleming Foundation, and welcome to the audio commentary track for On Her Majesty's Secret Service. In this commentary, we will be hearing from director Peter Hunt and many members of the cast and crew. The stories which you are about to hear reflect the personal recollections and opinions of those who provided the interviews. Some comments have been edited for time and clarity. They are not meant to provide the definitive history of the film. Peter Hunt believes that a director's films are a reflection of his personality. Fittingly, On Her Majesty's Secret Service begins with the literal reflection of Peter Hunt.
I'm going by. Watch for me. There I am. You had never seen that before, had you? I wanted to put on... I wanted to re-establish many things in this film. First of all, it's an extremely good story. On Her Majesty's Secret Service, I think, was one of Fleming's very best novels. And from a Bond point of view, it's an ideal story. And I went around, together with the script, always with a copy of the paperback or the copy of the book in my hand. And I continually looked at it and required to somehow make the story follow the book, which I hope I did.
Director Peter Hunt, who was noted for his innovative editing in the early 60s, faced the challenge of introducing a new James Bond to the public.
This is why, well, we agree after a lot of humming and hawing that we would not overemphasize the introduction of a new Bond. We would throw it away, rather like we'd done with a great many other things in the Bond films as a style, and just proceed with it. And I think it worked rather well. My idea to do all these close-ups of the various little bits and pieces which were Bond, the steel cigarette case, the lighter, and the glasses, and all these little bits, just to sort of, that was the introduction without actually seeing his face at all. I really was trying to do it so that the first close-up we actually see of him is My Name is Bond.
Although they opened the film, these scenes were among the last to be shot in mid-May 1969. Director Peter Hunt.
Oh, Marjorie Cornelius, my dress designer, who was a fantastic woman designer, designed this dress, which was really lovely, full of sequins, and was so beautiful on this girl. It's the sort of thing you walk into the sea with. Look at that, that's lovely.
Camera operator Alec Mills discusses his work on this scene.
If you look, as a camera operator, I would die when I saw it. I had to sit back in the back of a car going down over dunes like that. Well, that's almost impossible to operate. You know, you just, all you have to do is try to balance it, something in the frame. You can't put it to your eye because it would poke your eye out. And it worked out very well, but it's exactly what Peter wanted, as if the car was screaming down over the dunes. That was shot during the day. It's one of those cameramen things where we underexpose and do things like that, probably keep off the sky if we have to, or grad it if we've got a still camera. No, these are the tricks of the trade. We shot that normally during the day. There was no situation where you could see any shadows, whether the sun was coming from the top or whether it was long shadows in the evening. But to my as far as I can remember, it was definitely a normal day shoot. They just print it down.
Director of photography Michael Reed remembers shooting this scene.
It had to be shot at dawn. We had 2 days shoot on that, so the light was varying all the time. I tried to keep as much backlight as possible. And also, to begin with, I was underexposing by about 2.5 stops. And then gradually, as the fight sequence took place, I was able to allow more light to come into the exposure side of it, and that worked very well, but very difficult because, as I say, 2 days with varying light, it's not easy to get a balance on that. And we did shoot some process work on that as well.
Stunt arranger George Leach prepared this scene, as Peter Hunt recalls.
George was very good, wonderful, you know. And I would talk with him, and so we would discuss things, and I would say, you know, throw out a few ideas, and say, for instance, on the beach there, you know, it was my idea to put them in the water. They were rehearsing, and they were rehearsing on the sand. And I went down to see them rehearsing, you know, a sort of fisticuff fight, which George had choreographed, if you like. I said, what are you doing on the sand? Get in the water. George said, it's cold in the water. I said, I don't care, get in the water. It's much more exciting in the water, and I've got much more, I can splash, make a lot of noise, and all that sort, which is what we did. And then it actually, the bit where he puts the guy's face in the water and either kills him or blacks him out or whatever, at the end of that fight, was done in a tray at Palmer Studios.
Editor John Glenn cut the fight in Hunt's fast-paced style.
Well, you don't find the fight so because I jump it about in the cutting. I cut it as a fight should be cut. You've got to spend time on it. You've got to be very careful with it.
To help the Aston Martin race up the beach, production designer Sid Kane had to find a way to give the car traction in loose sand.
When you film any vehicle on soft sand, you've got a problem. And all I had to do was to get railway sleepers laid just underneath the surface to enable the car to zoom up the beach.
Peter Hunt took a chance with this scene, allowing the new James Bond to directly address the audience.
This never happened to the other fella.
Well, he had to be talking to the audience in order to say that line. That was the one, you know, one you take a liberty, the one moment you come out of the film and go back into it with the titles. It may have been more difficult if you were going on with another scene or whatever, but to go, boom, right into titles on that.
Bond's line works. Finding a theme song that worked was another matter. The challenge is to include the words "On Her Majesty's Secret Service" in the lyrics. Director Peter Hunt recalls the dilemma.
Oh, there was a lot of discussion about a title song because, as I said, you know, quite rightly in a way, the title song should have the title of the film. That's the benefit of it. But you could hardly have an On Her Majesty's Secret Service song. It would have to be some sort of march, I think. And we didn't really want to do that. I wasn't really keen on that idea.
Composer John Barry agrees with Peter Hunt.
I finally went and said, look, we can't use On Her Majesty's Secret Service, you know, as a song title, you know, unless we're going to do it like Gilbert and Sullivan, you know. And they said, no, we've really got a problem. So I said, let me write an instrumental for the opening.
To ease the transition of introducing a new actor as Bond, the film's titles incorporate images from five previous 007 adventures. Title designer Maurice Binder also incorporates an hourglass motif and a clock whose hands run backwards. Director Peter Hunt recalls Binder's work.
Yes, you're going back in time or whatever. I thought it was a good reference to the previous stories that we'd done and the audiences had seen. Without being heavy-handed, without being too... I thought it might be too obvious and heavy-handed, but somehow I thought it all worked rather nicely, especially with the music. The titles I loved, which Binder did of all the girls, but if you notice on... and the crown above. If you notice on the last title over mine, I get all the girls coming in, sitting there with their nipples. And I have to tell you, it was a big mistake, because in South Africa, they just cut that right out. They censored the whole thing. So it was never directed by anybody in South Africa. I lost my credit.
These scenes were shot in Portugal, but producer Harry Saltzman had other ideas.
Harry was very keen on us shooting all those foreign things in France, but I didn't find anywhere in France that I thought was particularly photogenic or hadn't been seen. Didn't fit the film that I was thinking about.
Good to see you, Manuel.
So we went to Portugal, and we went to a little place called Cascai, which is just outside Lisbon. And it's a pretty place in many ways, very beautiful. And the whole of the area is very beautiful. The hotel was the hotel we stayed in. which we put the unit in. It was a very nice hotel, and the pool and all that was real. That was all there. Again, I enhanced it a lot with going through to the gambling, the casino, by putting the reflection light in there, which again my friend Cliff Carley put in for me, and managed to put it in backwards so that we got the ripple which wiped it away, and all that you know, particularly delicate stuff that I enjoy very much.
Sid Kane was the film's production designer. Kane had previously been art director on Dr. No and production designer on From Russia with Love. Michael Reed remembers Sid Kane.
Sid Kane, our production designer, was very modern in his approach to the whole picture and knew what we wanted to do, the effect that we were trying to get with a practical look about it. And so he's one of the top production designers in the country.
Peter Hunt recalls working with director of photography Michael Reed.
Well, Michael Reed was my cameraman, and he'd done things for me before, and he shot all the opening title sequence for me, which I made and directed on Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and was so good, and the whole crew was so lovely and enjoyable to work with. I was very keen on everything. I had a it was the first film I was directing, and I was determined that it was going to be a good film. And I was determined to do everything I could in my power to make sure that it became a good film. I know that sounds all a bit conceited, but I have to tell you honestly that I was determined that it should be a good film. And I really worked awfully hard to try and fulfill that.
Since the character of Tracy in the book was a blonde, producers first wanted to cast Brigitte Bardot. When she proved unavailable, Peter Hunt chose Diana Rigg.
Diana Rigg was marvelous, absolutely marvelous. We were looking for, of course, I was very, if we're going to have a new Bond, I said, if we're going to have somebody, unless they are a star, unless they are a name in themselves, we've got to have a name gal, a leading lady, somebody who's an actress, somebody who will help in the whole thing. And so we were looking for a leading actress, a name. We looked at several young ladies with names. And it was Dennis Salinger, I think, her agent, who suggested her. And she came in to see us. And I liked her enormously. I've always liked her. I liked her in The Avengers as well. And I think Harry liked her a lot. And I think Cubby did. I don't think there was very much discussion about that. She said, I'll do anything to help you, whatever you would like me to do. Which I thought was so wonderful and magnanimous of such an actress. I think they did very well in the film. I think they did marvelously. And they acted beautifully together.
Throughout the film, the color purple reappears in the decor in the casino, in Blofeld's laboratory, in the gift wrapping of the presents at Pease Gloria, set dresser Peter Lamont.
Well, the thing is, it always looks, you know, purple. In those days, we had down the floor, we did the casino. I did all that with that drapery. I used them quite a few times after that, because they were always hanging up in the drapes of Pinewood, but that's all since gone. But it always looks the part. You know, sometimes, you know, there's all velour with gold fringe, but it always photographs very well. It looks very rich, and this is what we were trying to do, you know.
Stunt arranger George Leach first prepared this fight scene for George Lazenby's screen test, with Lazenby fighting wrestler Yuri Boryenko.
And I had to arrange a fight. I built a set especially for this fight scene with George Lazenby. And we did a very good fight scene. In fact, the fight scene for that test with the Russian wrestler he did it with, Yuri Boryenko, and I used the whole of the set, moved these two characters all the way around the set, smashed the thing up. And in actual fact, in the scene in the film, they use a fellow named Irving Allen, who wasn't quite as agile as Yuri, And the fight scene was very good in the film, but I still think the one we did as a test, I think that was the best fight that we did.
Whereas the earlier James Bond films featured high-key cinematography, director Peter Hunt wanted to take a different approach with this film.
Well, I wanted it to look glamorous. I wanted it to look really a super picture. By now, I thought that's what we ought to have. We'd gone through all the other attempts at making a difference. I felt that I really wanted... It was a simple, really, look that I wanted, but I wanted it to be glamorous. I wanted it to be like those wonderful films from Hollywood in the 50s that I had been brought up on and I enjoyed so much. That's what I was really after. I wanted it to look glamorous.
Director of photography Michael Reed recalls working with Peter Hunt.
With Peter Hunt, he was such a good director. I mean, and with great knowledge because of his experience in the editing department. With regard to camera angles, you didn't have to measure. He knew. And the thing was, what he did always insisted was this situation where it had to look real, the whole thing. But you shouldn't, the difficulty in this battle, you can make it look real, but you still have to keep a style of sophistication that the previous Bonds have had. And he said, well, that's fine, but as long as the sets don't look like sets, and this is what we endeavoured to do. And one of the things that I did, every set that we had in the studio had a ceiling to it, so it made it difficult to put backlight in.
Camera operator Alec Mills was in a unique position to observe the working relationship between Peter Hunt and Michael Reed, as he recalls.
The relationship between Peter and Michael was just unbelievable. Peter would do anything for Michael and vice versa. They just loved working together. I think Peter saw himself as an Ian Fleming. If not, and Ian Fleming reputedly saw himself, I think, as James Bond. I know how true that is. And I think Peter felt a little between James Bond and Ian Fleming himself. He was immaculate, quite right, the cufflinks and the coat, the tie. I don't recall seeing Peter without a tie. That was the man he was. It's a part of Peter's character. Everybody on the set, never a rude word, where some directors can be shout and scream or whatever like that. Not Peter. Peter's a different type, and from that I think he gets a lot more respect from the people around him and the people he works with on the actors and things like that. So I think, yes, he was a very elegant person. That's the word, elegant.
Peter Hunt had been working in the film industry since the age of 14 when he was a clapper boy at Merton Park Studios. In his 20s he became one of England's top film editors. This film marks his directorial debut.
I like to make the cinemascope, and I like to make the frame full. I like to have the frame interesting in every possible way. At the same time, we were very conscious of the fact that, you know, oh, one day it's going to go on television. So you still have to keep that in mind, that they'll knock off the sides and change the format a little. And we also kept that in mind in framing it and getting our scenes correct.
Throughout the film, flowers are linked to the character of Tracy, from the flowers at Marco and Stracco's birthday party during the bullfighting sequences, to the flowers in the wedding, even to the embroidered flowers on the wedding dress, and of course the flower that Tracy leaves for Bond here, director Peter Hunt recalls.
I said to my set dresser, we're going to have flowers. The wedding will be flowers. Don't worry about, how you're going to do it. I want it to be masses and masses of flowers. We're going to make it flowers all the way through. And it worked very well. I was conscious of it, of course, and carefully, watched it without making it too obvious. But small things like that help enormously. I like flowers in my own life and my own house, so I wanted it to be flowers. I thought it was a romantic thing to have flowers. That's why we have a little flower by the dressing gown there under there. You know, you can't say, well, you want to. It's difficult to give a Bond film the beauty, but at the same time you can make it, as indeed we've done all the others, into stylish pictures with a good taste and a reflection, which is what I always think of the director anyway. Why not? Perhaps we can make up a portal.
Fred Wilmington was in charge of finding vehicles for the James Bond films. On Her Majesty's Secret Service posed a special challenge for him, as he remembers.
They wanted a Rolls-Royce convertible. And back in those days, to get a Rolls-Royce convertible was like reaching for the moon. They were something like about 2 years delivery. That's if you could even get anyone to accept your order. However, I did manage to get one, but it meant that we had to pay well over the odds in list price for it. And we'd only had it, I know, about 48 hours before I was in the car and on my way to Switzerland for the first filming session.
For this scene, at Draco's Dockside headquarters, director Peter Hunt had a very unusual request.
Well, I had, again, such an idea. It wasn't scripted or anything anyway. I remember the night before when we were going through the list of artists and extras the following day. I said to my first assistant, "I want a midget." He looked at me very askance, and I said, "No, can you get..." "Yes, yeah, sure," he said. And I thought at that time it would be a great idea to have this midget cleaning the floor and whistling Goldfinger.
Exaggerated sound effects and John Glenn's fast-paced editing accentuate the action of this brief fight scene, as Peter Hunt recalls.
Well, I had to zush it up a bit, didn't I? I mean, it's, again, the whole idea of him defeating these three guys. I had to make it look like a lovely Bond thing.
"Do not kill me, Mr. Bond. At least not until we've had a drink."
Bursting into that office.
Peter Hunt was used to telling a story through editing, but as a director, he used many creative camera techniques.
I wanted to make an emphasis of this one. This is one I wanted particularly to make an emphasis. That's why I have him turn and look.
"But today is the 13th, Commander."
He even did a double take. And he went further than that and put his glasses on, which I rather liked when I saw it in the dailies. I thought that I wouldn't do it. In fact, I think I did one where he just turned and looked.
"Please sit down. I was not sure."
Set dresser Peter Lamont recalls special effects man John Steers' contribution to the knife-throwing shot.
"Actually, we did get in a knife thrower, you know, which he failed miserably, and John did it in his inimitable way, perfectly first time. So the thing is, you know, you always assume that knife throwers are going to do it accurately, but he made a real hash of it, and John said, well, I'll do it. Of course, put a wire onto it, and the knife went down perfectly first time, bang, we had it."
Knife throwing was the least of the problems in this scene, where much of the plot is explained, as director Peter Hunt recalls.
"Very difficult sequence to do this. What generally happens in filmmaking is the third reel is the plot reel. And it's always the reel that's the problem child in the film, generally, because you want to get the plot over, and it's got to be done with interest and style, as it were. And it's also very difficult because it slows all the film down. That, needless to say, this wasn't the third reel, but it's got the same problems. It's the whole plot of the story. We have to learn a great deal about this girl, and it takes a long time to get it across. I tried to make it look as interesting as I could with him moving about and doing various stage things in the most natural way that I could. I began to think at the end that it was working fine by the time I finished editing it and what have you. But it was a very difficult sequence."
Casting director Dyson Lovell worked closely with director Peter Hunt to fill the diverse roles of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Hunt recalls casting Gabriele Ferzetti.
"Well, Gabriele Ferzetti came about... who were we looking for? We were looking for Blofeld at that time. And Harry had suggested an actor whose name I can't remember now, who was in this Italian film. Well, I don't... He was in this Italian film. And Harry had suggested him, and I said to Dyson Lovell, I'd like to see this man. I've never seen anything that he's done.
And I know a lot of Italian actors, you know. I lived in Italy for 4 years. I was there all through my youth. But I didn't know who this actor was. Let's have a picture. Have we got a film or anything that he's in that I can run so that I see this man, you know, before we interview him or he comes to see us? And they got a film for me, an Italian film, about mafiosa, you know, some one of those Italian pictures. And we sat to look at it, and in looking at it, one of the parts, there was this great-looking guy. And I said, oh, I don't know about Logo, I don't know about the other guy. That's the man we should have as Dinah's father. Yes, that's who we should have as Marco and Stracco. And then eventually after we finished the film, I watched the whole thing, and I said to Dyson, do you know this man? Do you know anything about him? Oh, yeah, he said, he's a good actor. I said, he looks great. He would be perfect as Diana Rigg's father. And he said, yeah, I think he would be.
Because of Frizzetti's accent, David DeKaiser dubbed him in the film. Diana Rigg's mother also appears in the scene, as Peter Hunt explains.
If you look at that picture on the back there, that is a picture of Diana Rigg's mother. Next week
is my birthday. Director of photography Michael Reed remembers working with actor Gabriel Frizzetti.
Gabriel Frizzetti, the actor that played Draco. Very nice man, easy to work with, ideal for the part. Had this charm with a hidden sense of humor.
Peter Hunt's desire to make the film look glamorous extended to actress Lois Maxwell.
I think pine no more. Mainly because I had her dressed very well, but I think Lois Maxwell was better in this film as Moneypenny than she was in any of the others. Oh, I'm prejudiced, of course.
Peter Hunt was very pleased with the light touch captured by the actors in this scene, as he explains.
I wanted them to do that, and he's very good in it, extremely good playing that little flippant scene.
As both editor and second unit director on prior Bond films, Hunt was already well acquainted with Bernard Lee and Lois Maxwell.
Well, you must remember I knew them all. You know, they were lovely stock characters. I'd worked with them in post-syncing and all the other bits and pieces that come out of the editing and what have you in the previous films. So they weren't strangers to me or anything like that. They were just, and they're very good artists, you know.
Cinematographer Michael Reed, a newcomer to the world of James Bond, was very impressed with the performances of Bernard Lee and Lois Maxwell.
Bernard and Lois were so well suited for the part. I don't think they had to be directed, quite honestly. They knew it off pat, and they just were the characters as soon as they went in front of the camera.
Lois Maxwell recalls working with George Lazenby.
George was young and delicious, and the girls were falling in front of him like pieces of confetti. I think he did a very good job. I met him recently again, and he's a very nice man.
This is the only time we see Bond's office. The items in his desk are Honey Rider's belt and knife from Dr. No, Red Grant's watch, as seen in From Rush With Love, and the rebreather from Thunderball. Back to Peter Hunt.
This is a sequence that somewhere along the line could drop out if we really needed to. But it became so good, and when I saw that piece of set dressing there with Her Majesty, I suddenly thought, we'll use that. And I said to my cameraman, let's get a reflection of him saying, sorry, ma'am, in there. And it worked. Look, it was not, it progressed us, it got us to this point, and it wasn't tasteless, it was very harmlessly done, and actually very nicely done, I think.
Since On Her Majesty's Secret Service, gave Miss Moneypenny a wedding scene as well as the usual office scene, costume fittings for Lois Maxwell were more elaborate than usual.
Now, all these clothes were designed for me and built on my body, and I don't know, I had something like 8 fittings for them, and there was a special bra built, and oh, went on and on. And I was promised the clothes once the film had opened. And I went to Pinewood to collect them the day after the opening, and somebody else had collected them. They could not be found. And it really broke my heart.
We are now on location in Portugal. Back to director Peter Hunt.
Now, one of my favorite shots. She looks so beautiful in this. I love the whole scene. This is a great scene shot in Portugal of the Vinhos estate. This is an enormous estate, some thousands of acres. And they had their own private, small bull ring. Of course, in Portugal, you know, they don't kill the bull. They only play with it on the field, in the ring.
The Portuguese have their own style of bullfighting, as director Peter Hunt explains.
Well, they do this bit of nonsense, lining up with it, and then they give it a chance.
These scenes, shot near the end of production in May 1969, featured a large group of extras. 75 birthday guests were called for, 60 peasants, 20 children, a bullfighter, 12 waiters, and 4 waitresses. Director Peter Hunt.
And I demanded that we have a whole, all the extras are nice, pretty young girls and boys.
Mr. Bond, may I introduce my daughter, Teresa?
All youthful, good-looking, aristocratic. Now, he looks jolly good, doesn't he? You tell me that isn't a James Bond, it certainly is. She looks excellent, too.
She likes you, I can see it.
You must give me the name of your oculist.
Well, I had him smart. I dressed him like I dress. Went to my tailor.
I didn't know Mr. Bond knew. Like James Bond, Peter Hunt was also a very stylish dresser, as director of photography Michael Reed remembers.
Peter Hunt was very smart, dapper, and always looked smart.
George Lazenby's stand-in was Jack Dearlove. Dearlove played the singing prisoner in 1987's Empire of the Sun, and was Harrison Ford's stand-in for all 3 Indiana Jones movies. Now Peter Hunt tells us more about Portuguese bullfighting.
Of course, in Portugal, you know, they don't kill the bull. They only play with it on the field, in the ring. Well, this is exactly what happens. They challenge the bull, and he comes charging at them, and they're supposed to grab him around the horns and hold his head and lie him down.
Virginia North, who plays Olympe, also appears opposite Vincent Price in the cult classic The Abominable Dr. Fives, a film that also featured future Bond woman Carolyn Monroe as Fives' wife, Victoria. Handling this delicate scene required great skill, but director Peter Hunt was up to the task.
I like this scene. This is a beautifully, even though I say it myself, it is a beautifully shaped dialogue scene. Played beautifully and edited beautifully and leads us right into their romantic beginnings.
And without obligation.
And then I'm not sure obligation.
Remember, Bond had never had a romantic, real serious romantic attachment before. So it was a difficulty. I wanted it believable. I didn't want to make it sort of kiss kiss bang bangish, as in fact we had done so often with Sean. But I wanted to make it something that was had some sincerity behind it, so that it had some feeling.
There may be a connection between that man Blofeld.
And I hoped also that that, of course, would affect the ending of the film, that you would also have feeling by the time we got to the end of it. And whatever happened, you know, what happens to them.
On Her Majesty's Secret Service features one of the great scores of the 007 series, courtesy of John Barry, who earned an Oscar in 1967 for Born Free. Barry talks about writing music for James Bond love scenes.
The romantic side of Bond, the love interest, if you like, or whatever, that's always been much easier, more easily accessible to me to write. It's just a question of getting an attractive song. It's much more free form. You know, it's like you spend a couple of days walking on the beach, getting an idea, sit down and write it. And if the melody works, it's going to work with the picture. Truly is. It always works. A good melody over the right scene. It's just undeniable.
Writing a love theme for On Her Majesty's Secret Service allowed John Barry to work with one of his idols, jazz legend Louis Armstrong.
Louis had been ill for about a year in hospital, etc., etc. And the line "We have all the time in the world" was the last line in the script or in the book. And I said to Kerry Broccoli, "I'm trying to think who, somebody who can bring some kind of irony to that title." And I said, "I think it's Louis Armstrong." And let's not go with some, you know, out and out pop person. He went for it. And we talked to Louis' agent in New York, wrote the song. Hal David wrote the lyric. And we came to New York and recorded it. And he was just quite amazing. And what was almost broke my heart at the end is when we were all through, he thanked me. Nothing less. I was very moved. And I felt rather stupid, you know. But it was such a nice thing of him to do. And I get kind of teary-eyed when I think about it, because it was the last thing he did. And it was perhaps it's probably my favorite Bond song.
This sequence was shot in November 1968 in Bern, Switzerland. Look closely when Bond arrives, and you'll see stuntman Richard Graydon as Draco's chauffeur, director Peter Hunt.
This, again, luck. Had to have luck. Not the rain, but the building opposite and the crane. Where will you find a building opposite, which was scripted, which was written in the book, that really fits so well the scene?
The interiors of Gumbold's office were shot 4 months later, in March 1969, on Stage B at Pinewood Studios. Director Peter Hunt.
This is a set inside, but all the stuff outside is real.
George Lazenby's public association with the James Bond persona did not end after On Her Majesty's Secret Service. In 1983, he appeared in the TV movie Return of the Man from U.N.C.L.E. as a British spy with the initials JB, who drove an Aston Martin. He also played a 007-type character in the Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode, Diamonds Aren't Forever. Michael Reed remembers George Lazenby.
George Lazenby, I liked him. I got on very well with him. George, I think, had all the basic characteristics of the character. His double takes at different times, I think, worked very well.
After On Her Majesty's Secret Service, Lazenby traveled to Hong Kong, where Bruce Lee offered him a co-starring role in his next film. Unfortunately, Lee passed away just a few days later. Peter Hunt has said in interviews that his style was influenced by the works of David Lean and Carol Reed, both of whom, like Hunt, were editors before they became film directors. As this scene shows, Hunt was also influenced by Alfred Hitchcock.
I wanted to put into it, it wasn't scripted, of course, or anything like that, but I wanted to put into it something that I hoped would be a suspenseful bit.
Like many sequences in Hitchcock's films, this is a long scene without dialogue. Yet, with clever editing and John Barry's music, Hunt steadily builds the suspense.
I like the way that he gets everything ready and we don't know what it's for. Now, this whole thing of actually finding a building being built there, and a crane, and a clock, all this was in the same area. All that was, we were able to shoot all this in the same area.
There's an interesting addition to the construction site from production designer Sid Kane, the signage of Draco Construction. Back to Peter Hunt.
And we were able to use that crane and swing it right across the road over to him.
The safe-cracking apparatus is similar to a pocket-sized version Bond carried in You Only Live Twice, but this one also features a photocopying machine.
What I like most of all, which was not my idea, I think it must have been Maybaum's idea or in the scripting of it, was the apparatus for opening the safe. It's so ludicrous, but I love the whole idea.
The safecracker is the only gadget that James Bond uses in Majesties. Peter Hunt made a conscious choice to make James Bond rely more on his own resources.
We had begun veer away from a style which had been tremendously good. I was very, very deliberately obstinate about bringing it back, you know. And I knew that the book of, as I said before, it was such a good story. It was all there. It was a story. That was the thing. It didn't require a lot of gimmicks just to, you know, jazz it up and try and hide the story. The story was tremendously good.
Here we see Diana Rigg in another fabulous Marjorie Cornelius outfit. The production kept Cornelius busy. There are over 20 costume changes for James Bond alone. While Bond waits for the safecracker to do its job, he finds a copy of Playboy magazine hidden in the newspapers. Interestingly, On Her Majesty's Secret Service was the first Ian Fleming novel to be serialized in the April, May, and June 1963 issues of Playboy. Director Peter Hunt.
Oh, it's all just fun. Just fun idea. Whilst we tried to build up something, I tried to put a bit of humor in whatever suspense there was in that whole thing. I was never sure that it would work. I like the way it just falls off. I love it.
At the time of the release of On Her Majesty's Secret Service, photocopying machines were not yet commonplace items to be found in every office. So even in a movie that downplays gadgetry, the filmmakers introduced a machine that, at the time, seemed exotic. Working such machinery is not always easy for an actor to do and still give a performance, as Peter Hunt explains.
One of the most complicated things for an actor is this sort of mechanical stuff. It's not easy to do, funnily enough. Not when you're concentrating on, you know, the character you are and the part you are. You're awfully tied up with a lot of doing this here and that there and pressing this button.
Director of photography Michael Reed recalls a notable shot.
It had been raining all morning and cleared by the afternoon, and we spotted this heavy shadow. The sun was very low. And we thought it would be a good idea to use that as an effect. I think it worked. But it was a lucky break, actually.
Peter Hunt recalls the kind of brainstorming sessions that went into the development of On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
I think various gadgets were brought up at one time or another. You know, the development of these films by now, because I've been with them for quite a long while, and they, you know, we all knew one another, and we were really a teamwork. So ideas came and were thrown around, and some were taken and some were thrown out. We did put that little bit of nonsense in where he opens the safe in Grunwald's office, which I noticed on various occasions for time, no doubt, I hope, various people have cut out. I don't know why. It always annoys me, of course. It annoys all directors.
As with Bond's office, On Her Majesty's Secret Service is the only film in which we see M's home, quarterdeck. Director Peter Hunt.
This I love, too, because it's the only time it ever has been in a film. This is, and Fleming put it into several, you know, this is M's house, including his manservant, who was a petty officer in the Navy with him.
Hunt remembers veteran James Bond screenwriter Richard Maybaum.
I tried to bring it all to, you know, so that it was all Bond. Great line here, too. I didn't think you expertise in sort of lepidoptery.
Unusually small for Nymphalus polychlorus.
A great experienced filmmaking man.
You know, he'd been his own producer with MGM, and he'd done all sorts of things. He'd been right through the business. So he was an extremely experienced operator, experienced writer, and a very warm-hearted man, very kind and nice. And I just found him a delightful person. And I also think he was very good at adapting a book to the screen, which is really a talent in itself. Very difficult to do that side of it. You might want to add things later and a bit more dialogue or put in a bit more, character or whatever. But he was terrific at that. Because it really did bring back the style of James Bond. You know, the well-dressed man about town.
I've also been reading up on the technical side of heraldry.
Very unusual, nice sequences. This is, in fact, the College of Arms, of course. That's a set which Sid Kane built, which is a complete replica of the entrance hall at the College of Arms.
Here we see 007's coat of arms with the motto, "The world is not enough," which provided the title for the 1999 James Bond film. Actor George Baker, who plays Sir Hilary Bray, recalls meeting Fleming.
I was under contract to ABBC, and Robert Clark was the chief executive. I think they call them something else, but it doesn't matter. And we were having lunch at the Mirabel, and which was a wonderful London restaurant. And Ian Fleming came over and he said, "Now, Robert, here you are. You have got to do these James Bond books. And there is your James Bond sitting with you." And Robert Clark said, "Ian, they'll never make films." So, sadly, he passed on the chance. And when Cubby and Harry took over, Ian wrote to them and said, "I actually think George Baker would be very good James Bond. I was never seen for the part." And he wrote me a sweet letter saying, "I'm very sorry, but I think when a writer introduces an actor, perhaps they don't want to know." So that was my first introduction. Peter rang me and said, "No, would you come down to the studio? Because what we'd love you to do, if you wouldn't mind, is George's voice when he's imitating Hilary Bray isn't quite right. So we'd like you to dub it." It was an extraordinary thing to do, actually. From the idea that Ian Fleming said, "Why don't you be James Bond?" to be in a studio in Pinewood with the things on, dubbing the voice of James Bond was a very funny turnaround.
The weather in the Swiss location proved problematic for the filmmakers, as Peter Hunt recalls.
At Lauterbrunnen Station, which was one of the very first and early things we shot, I used to have to bring truckloads of snow down and spread it around to make it look like it had snowed. It was the mildest winter for 40 years in Switzerland.
On Her Majesty's Secret Service would be the final film of actress Ilse Steppett, whose career began at the age of 15 when she played Joan of Arc. Steppett died shortly before the release of Majesty's.
Ilse Steppett, big star in Germany when she was a young girl, of course, much younger. Also a good actress, very good. And ideal for Irma Bunt. This is where we had that terrible scene. It was an early, one of several early scenes with her, and she was extremely good in it. A little nervous and very apprehensive about the snow, and she didn't want to fall over. And we had a lovely trolley shot on the rails, using the rails of the trolley shot. And the train was about to come in and everything was going on. All these extras with the skis and that were just ordinary people who were around there skiing. And we were right in the middle of this nice tracking shot when one of the skiers came by, an extra, and knocked her flying. I could have died, a poor girl. She wasn't hurt or anything, but it just ruined the whole shot.
We had a big crew and a big cast, of course. And we lived in the hotels in Murren. We had a lot of amusing times. The food was great, and the hotel people and the whole of the people who lived in Murren, of which there weren't very many, enjoyed us being there, I think, and were extremely kind. They looked after us very well. It was marvellous.
We were, you know, in the book it's described as a clinic on the top of a piss, so having a peak, you know, they call it a piss. Piss Gloria is this sanatorium, which is run by Blofeld as a doctor for his devices. And it's private, and it's cut off from the skiing public at a point below it, so that it's completely untouched. You can't get at it. It's completely secure. And very difficult to find. We looked everywhere. We were looking everywhere. Find something at the top of a peak. And when we were scouting around, we were in St. Moritz, and my production manager, who was Swiss, said, I've just been talking to this man at the bar, and he tells me they're building a big restaurant, a revolving restaurant, on the top of the Schilthorn in Murren. It's not open yet, and it sounds like it might be something you're looking for. We were going off the next day to look at some other thing. I sent him off, and I said, well, you know what we're looking for. You've been with us, and we've been describing what we want. If you think there's a chance, give me a call this evening, and we'll come out and have a look at it. I mean, it was quite a long way from where we were at that time. And he called me, and he said, I think this is just what you're looking for. We got on the train and came to see him the next day, and there was this circular, perfect sanatorium, and they had just finished constructing the building. They had not yet put up cable car to it, and they had done nothing inside, but they were planning to make a revolving restaurant, which eventually they did. Well, when we looked at it, it was just wonderful, because there was a place before you get there where you have to change cable cars before you take the final cable car up to the very top of the peak. It really could have, you know, been the thing that Fleming had written about.
After scouting several locations, the filmmakers discovered an unfinished restaurant atop the Schilthorn Bahn in the Swiss Alps. It became Pease Gloria. Peter Hunt talks about the location.
At that time, we had no cable car up to it. Anyway, it was absolutely ideal. I said, it's going to be ideal. It's perfect. It's perfect. We must have it. We must have it. And then, of course, wheels were set into motion as to who it was, how it was, and what have you. And a long deal of discussion and what have you. The long and short being, of course, we got it. We built the heliport that we built on. This whole thing that was never intended to be there, but we constructed that for the film because we needed it. This is absolutely real, all this. And the interior of the revolving restaurant, Sid Kane designed, and we made into the set that we want, and left them with all the interior. Well, with that piece of luck of finding this place and then getting and negotiating and being able to get it, you know, the fact that by the time we wanted to shoot, the cable car would be on and all the various things, we were very lucky indeed. Now, just in order to not to make it too obvious as well, in order to give some authenticity to the state of Bond, the Sir Hilary Bray, when we got it all cut together, I carried George Baker's voice on through George of Sir Hilary Bray, so that the audience got a complete continuity of the voice that we'd heard. I mean, we do it so smoothly, and I hope professionally, that the majority of the audience are not immediately aware of it. it may dawn on some, it may dawn on not dawn on some, it will just follow on with the story. He is supposed to impersonate Sir Hilary Bray, and my intention was to help the actor all I could, the actor in George Lazenby, to accomplish the part, as it were. And I thought it was the better way to go, to schedule it so that we didn't have him playing Bond to start with. So that, in fact, he could get a bit nervous if he wanted to, because that would be Hilary Bray. So that he could become a different character. But by the time we went to shoot Bond, as Bond, I mean, he had become accustomed to the unit, to the, everything that he might not have been accustomed to. So, and me, and various ways of working. So that it was a shrewd, if you like, you know, it was a cunning way to start it. And it gave us to be able to look at him and see what he was like.
Bond's room at Peace Gloria is actually a set on Pinewood Studios' B stage, shot a few weeks after filming Wrapped at Peace Gloria. But there was one shot that was done on the mountaintop location.
I wanted to show the state of the room. It's a very nice set anyway. And I also wanted to tie it in with the outside, because we have various escapes and outside thing, and I drew upon it in which to get this rather nice trick shot, not even especially big, of the helicopter going, taking off, and leaving the helipad to go to wherever.
George Lazenby has a natural air of assurance that Peter Hunt tried to capture for the film.
I mean, he had a natural instinct about him. He had that's what I was saying, you know, from the model point of view. He had a natural way of moving, and he did it all naturally. What I was really concerned about was not destroying it, but making sure that it would come out as it naturally as it could. That he didn't stiffen up suddenly when we were doing something, which is a natural thing to do.
Impersonating Sir Hilary Bray, Bond dons a Scottish kilt, showing 007 opening a suitcase and removing the kilt was Hunt's way of preparing the audience for the sight of Bond in such uncharacteristic attire.
And this was great, too. I mean, I had to do that because I was a little concerned that when he came out of this lift, it would be just too unbelievable. But he looked so good in his Scottish regalia. And so I tried to, without giving it away too much, just take the edge off it by having him undo the case and take out his kilt. And this was very nice. They're all my lovely, they've all gone on, practically all of them, to be very good actresses. Joanna Lumley sitting there knitting.
Angela Sklar appeared in the 007 spoof Casino Royale before joining the cast of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. She talks about her role.
The idea of using glasses for Ruby was something which, I suppose in the 60s, it was all that Oliver Goldsmith kooky kind of look. And I'd sort of patented that. Because I'm as blind as a bat. And I used to wear these big round owl glasses, and they said, oh, it'd be great for Ruby, you know, she can look over the top of it and all that kind of stuff. And it also made you something that wasn't just pretty, it made you into something a bit kooky and sort of peculiar. She was a sort of North Country girl, and she wasn't the regular stunning lady.
When the filmmakers arrived, the interior of Peace Gloria had yet to be finished. Production designer Sid Kane recalls the challenges of dressing the mountaintop location.
It was terrific making that, designing that set. As I say, it had to be made for real. It had to withstand snow pressures and wind, strong wind things and so forth. I designed so that the set revolved, so that when you were sitting at a table, the Eiger and the mountains came into view.
The Alpine Room dinner scene began filming November 4th, 1968, and continued for 4 days. Angela Sklar remembers the scene.
Anything to do with eating can be problematical. I mean, you can find that you start laughing uncontrollably. because when you eat something, it's either hard or too soft or too big or too little. You take a rather large mouthful or you choke or something. So there's always something that makes you laugh. So as far as I can remember, there was quite a lot of laughing that went on, laughing when you shouldn't, and also a lot of eating pretty grotty chicken. I mean, there's enough that you can have eating sort of boiled chicken leg, but several times over, or many times over, it's a bit much.
Shooting in a studio, a cinematographer is able to precisely control the lighting of a scene. Shooting on location, however, presents difficulties, particularly when it comes to lighting a set with a wall of clear windows. Director Peter Hunt recalls how Michael Reed met the challenge.
The windows, according to the light changes, had to have different filters on them. All those windows were fitted for filters, and we had like four or five different filters. So when the light changed, you had to change all those around wherever I was shooting, put new filters on.
And now, director of photography, Michael Reed.
He said, I'll take you out to Pittsburgh. We're going to do a location recce with Sid Kane, the production designer. The difference with the lighting, I mean, outside, there was a difference of 4 to 5 stops, which... compared with what we could get away with inside, because, I mean, the T4 was the stop that we could get away with without upsetting the artist, you know. And I thought, well, we've got to break this light down. So I got in touch with ICI, and I got them to make up a series of neutral densities and an added increase in red of the 85 filter. All the neutral densities were arranged and they'd done that, but they said they couldn't meet the date for the 85 plus. So I spoke to Sid Kane about it. He said, we'll talk to Peter Lamont. And between them, they said, if we build a tank, I think it was 8x6 or 8x10, because there were 36 windows in this Pitts Gloria there. And... So we need 36 sheets of acrylic, plain acrylic. And Bert Driscoll there, who was the man who dyed all the gelatine filters that went into the lamps, he said, I called him in, and I said, look, if we get this tank, can we dye this perspex? So he said, yes. Yeah, he said, no problem. I said, well, how can you do it in 2 weeks? He said, 2 weeks? I said, yeah, that's all we've got. He said, I'll do my best. And so they built me 2 tanks. We dyed this filter, and it was perfect. With lighting the cavern sequence, I talked to Sid about it, and we put in some lights for the walls, so to give us some form of light source that we could use. And again, mainly I was using small lights, inky dinkies and pups. I never came any higher than a pup then. And... which is the small 750-watt lamp with a condenser. And we had to hide everything in there by flagging each lamp off as we set it. So the use of the angled pieces that Sid put in for me, the rock formations and things like that, we were able to get away with hiding lamps. And it worked out very well.
Telly Savalas won an Academy Award nomination for his first screen role in 1962's The Birdman of Alcatraz. He co-starred later with Diana Rigg in The Assassination Bureau. Peter Hunt remembers the actor.
Wonderful Telly, he was lovely. I didn't know him beforehand, but he was a great friend of Cubby's. They gambled together. They enjoyed gambling and going to the casinos. And I think that's, well, they probably knew one another here. But I'd always been an admirer of Telly. I'd always liked the stuff that he'd done. It was Cubby's idea. What about Telly for... I think they'd always talked about working together. Had he got earlobes? I think that was the first thing. Had he got earlobes? I couldn't remember. Of course, he has got earlobes, and we had to clip them back in order to conform to the storyline. But he was... I found him a joy to work with again. He fell right into the part.
You'll have them.
Like so many American actors, they're wonderfully professional. Whether you like them or you don't like them, or whether, you know, they're right, they have such a wonderful professionalism about their performances. But I think it's a joy. I've always found it a great deal of pleasure working with American actors. All of the, oh, I have with everybody, all the English actors, I've got a great deal of pleasure out of working with them. But he particularly, he used to, whilst we were rehearsing or getting lit or whatever, he used to like to sing into the mic. He would sing quietly. He fell in love, Danny Sheridan, who was the daughter of Diana Sheridan, who was a famous actress in England.
Elie Savalas began a romance with actress Danny Sheridan while on location at Peas Gloria. Angela Sklar has fond memories of the actor.
Danny Savalas was great. He was very down to earth, and he became very friendly with somebody on the movie that I was particularly fond of. And in fact, they got together. She was called Danny Sheridan, and they got together for about 10 years. They lived together afterwards, and so I used to get lovely bits of kind of ideas about what I had various things I wanted to do, and he was very sensible and gave very sensible things to do for a young actress and what to go for and what to. So I got some extra advice.
Making the world of James Bond convincing to a film audience is a formidable task. A director must find the right cocktail of wit and style without lampooning the character. Peter Hunt explains his approach to solving the problem.
One of the secrets of Bond is the sincerity with which they're made. They may be fun, and out of them comes the fun, but when you're actually making them, you must make them with conviction and professionalism and sincerity, even though, so that you must give each one of the characters a realness, as it were. Otherwise, it just becomes a carry-on. Hey, all this is nonsense. If we didn't do this sincerely, this is absolute nonsense. Bit of thing through that. But you believe it when you're seeing the film, and you should do, and I want you to.
Majesties is a mammoth film for a first-time director, but Peter Hunt was well prepared for the task, as he recalls.
It isn't like I came in green. I didn't come in to do my first film. I had cut a lot of big pictures. I had directed second units. I had got people out of trouble. I had known how to cheat, how to cut things differently, how to make it work. So my mind was always thinking about the film and how it would look. And of course I worried. I worried all the time. I mean, we did scenes, and I immediately said to young Ben Rayner, who I've got as my editor, for goodness sake, get those dailies in. I want to look at them. Let's cut them together quickly, see if it's, oh, look at this and look at that.
These shots of the corridors and upcoming shots outside and inside Ruby's room were all sets at Pinewood Studios.
I must say, he looks good. He wears that very well. He liked wearing that too, you know.
The love scene between Bond and Ruby was shot at Pinewood in late January 1969. Angela Sklar remembers filming the scene.
We had laughs. I mean, you always do if you end up in bed together, and you're all covered up all over, especially in those days. You never actually appeared with no clothes on. You had, you had knickers on, and you had your boobs taped up, usually, so that nobody could see what you looked like. But, I think we were just trying to get it right. I mean, there was giggles, of course.
Peter Hunt was very impressed with Angela Sklar.
Miss Angela Sklar, she was very professional, lovely, lovely, lovely girl, and very funny. How did you get here? She was another one of those actresses I insisted upon, you know, and it was a nice little part with some good dialogue lines, so I wanted somebody who could contain it, somebody who would make it work for us. And Angela Sklar was a little up-and-coming actress as a comedy actress, really. And she came to see me, you know, when we were doing one of those casting sections. And it was love at first sight. I said, yes, she'd be great, wonderful. Let's look for anybody else.
Glad to I have this awful allergy about chickens. My family's got a chicken.
Mark, you, when you think of him, look how good he is. He's really, really very good with these scenes. With her. His looks and everything were wonderful. And I wouldn't have it any other way. As I said before, you know, editing my own film, I wasn't going to show him in any light other than that it would be as good as I could have got.
Likewise, Skulor had a high opinion of Hunt.
He was incredibly kind, incredibly sweet, and I was madly in love with some American, I think, and it was my 21st birthday or something like that. Or 22nd, and he said, I'll fly him over from America. It was lovely, and I had my birthday party there, and everybody was enchanting. And Peter was, I mean, Peter had cut a lot of the movies before, and so he had lots of ideas of interesting, extraordinary shots. You'd be shot from underneath a glass table, and we'd say, how many times have we got to do this blooming piece? And he'd say, well, I have got one extraordinary shot. I want to get one more shot.
The interior of Ruby's room showcased another extraordinary Sid Kane set. That Kane was around to design the set is, in itself, extraordinary. In 1943, at the height of World War II, his fighter plane crashed in Rhodesia, breaking his back and injuring his legs. 9 months later, after he had recovered, he was relaxing in an open-sided RAF hut when a thunderstorm brewed up and he was struck by lightning. Luckily, Kane escaped both incidences without permanent injury. Director Peter Hunt worried about making the hypnosis of the women at Peace Gloria convincing.
It is remarkable what you can do in film. I mean, I really felt that this was a little bit unbelievable to put across. And yet, when it was finished and done, it worked very well. The idea that they're hypnotized and the whole premise of their being guinea pigs for worldwide crime such as this.
Hilly, you old devil.
Appearing as German allergy patient Nancy is the lovely Catherine von Schell. Von Schell's first movie was 1964's Lana, Queen of the Amazons. She later appeared in the television series Space, 1999, and acted opposite Richard Harris in 1977's Gulliver's Travels, directed by Peter Hunt. Now retired from acting, von Schell, under the name Catherine Hayes, runs a bed and breakfast in the Lavian region of France.
Perhaps if we turn on the light.
Peter Hunt recalls working with the actress.
Picture yourself.
Catherine von Schell, I cast her as in my Gulliver's Travels, as Gulliver's wife. We had several scenes in the beginning of that film where he's with his wife. And she was great with Richard Harris.
What'd you say?
Angela Skulor also remembers working with Catherine von Schell.
Catherine von Schell, she was extremely beautiful, sick-making, in fact. She was also very, very nice. And I think there was a sort of thing. There were some girls who were models, who were actresses, and then there were the ones who were the actresses, and Catherine was an actress, as opposed to a model.
Shooting at the 10,000-foot peak of the Schiltorn Bond in the Swiss Alps and the village of Muren below proved ideal for director Peter Hunt.
And also the geography of that worked very well, too. And this, the reverse side of it, which is as far as the public can go, and there is the clinic or sanatorium at the top. And this is all real. This is there. I was only there a few weeks ago. Wasn't full of snow then, but hardly full of snow now. You can see the problems we had, because here we are at 6,000 feet, and the snow is not that great up here. At the station where we came in on the train, we were bringing snow down and spreading it around where we were shooting. This is the scene that I told you about. But in fact, in the film, it brings Campbell back. That's his purpose. It brings Campbell back into the scene, into the film, and also shows us additionally that how private it is up there and how nobody is allowed. which then in turn makes it believable the scene that we get at the top when Campbell has been discovered trying to climb up there.
The 120-man crew of Majesty's had to travel to the mountaintop location by cable car, a 3,000-foot, 20-minute journey. Director Peter Hunt.
The great asset that I had was that we were shooting 3,000 meters up, and I had control of the cable car. So nobody could come up onto my set without I knew or I could stop. And when we started, every time the red light went up and we started shooting, the cable car stopped. And whether you were hanging there for half an hour whilst we were shooting or not, I didn't care. That was not my doing. I was more concerned with my film.
When Ian Fleming was writing the novel on Her Majesty's Secret Service, his working title was Hell's Bells. Peter Hunt worried about making the plot work.
I had doubts about, I must say, I had great doubts about 12 girls out there all being cured of various of malfunctions, of allergies, as Irma Bunt said, and as was in the book. I had tremendous fears about that because I thought that would perhaps be very corny and not be a broad, I wouldn't be able to bring it about properly. But I don't know, perhaps my praying and worrying and all the things I did worked because it eventually came off, and nobody was more happy and surprised than I was.
Bernard Horsfall, who plays Campbell, Bond's associate, would later appear in two other Peter Hunt films, Gold and Shout at the Devil, both of which starred Roger Moore. Horsfall can be seen in the Academy Award Best Picture winners Gandhi and Braveheart. Peter Hunt remembers working with the 6 foot, 3 inch tall actor.
Wonderful. Another good actor, Bernard Horsfall, plays Campbell.
In the novel On Her Majesty's Secret Service, Bond encounters Blofeld face to face for the first time. In the film, Bond and Blofeld have already met in the movie version of You Only Live Twice. But Bond's vague disguise appears to fool Blofeld for a short period of time. Peter Hunt also had to change Telly Savalas' appearance to conform with the script.
I had to tuck his ears up so that he didn't have any lobes. He was extremely good. He was very suggestive about various things. Now, when he does, when he gets nervous and does that on his collar, you know, when he's talking in the laboratory. I don't know if you notice little things like that. Well, occasional things, you know.
Hunt knows the value of communicating with his actors.
Actors are very good and helpful when you talk to them about their character and you just say, you know, well, I'd like something not too obvious, just a little different.
After shooting Wrapped on Her Majesty's Secret Service, Peas Gloria opened its doors as a restaurant, which to this day capitalizes on its James Bond connection. Obviously, Catherine Bonshell's character has taught Bond an easier way to break out of his room. When Bond is knocked out, we see the first use of slow motion in a James Bond film. Director Peter Hunt remembers the conversations he had with Michael Reed regarding the look he hoped to achieve with On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
I could talk with him about how I wanted the film to look, as opposed to anything else, which I did do, of course, and he would then in turn converse with me and talk about things and how, and as the script came along, he would have a script and we would talk about the scenes and how we would do it, and eventually he came out to the locations before we started shooting so that he could talk about lighting and how he could do this.
The Christmas tree in Blofeld's quarters reminds us that the film takes place over the holiday season, but the mood of the scene is anything but jolly.
Right.
This is a good scene. I like this scene very much with Telly putting something on there. Those girls.
Though he was sometimes concerned about the mammoth size of the production, Hunt did not allow the actors to see his worry. Director Peter Hunt.
I had to give the atmosphere of confidence because I wanted a confident film. I had to give the idea of glamour because I wanted a glamorous film. So whatever I wanted, I had to play that part. I had to give that idea. As a film director, you've got to be an actor, too.
You've got to perform in order to get what you visually see there.
Hunt and Michael Reed decided early on to use as many ceilings on their sets as possible. This meant instead of the sets being lit from the top, they had to be lit from the sides, as if they were actual locations. Reed and Hunt felt this would make it easier to match location shots with shots filmed in the studio.
Well, what we did was, what you do most of the time, if you've got any sense, is you have pieces of ceiling, so you bring them into the setup that you're going to do. And you just move them around then, wherever you can. So that if you put ceilings in them, then it does upset the cameraman, you know. But Michael Reed and I have been friends for a long while, and we discuss things so that there is no, you know, there's no problem about it. And if he can't do whatever it is that I'm asking, you know, he'll say, and maybe have other suggestions, and we'll make other arrangements or whatever it is, try and get the best out of it.
This was the first James Bond film for camera operator Alec Mills, who had later become director of photography on The Living Daylights and License to Kill. Peter Hunt recalls Alec Mills.
He was one of the finest operators that there were in Britain. I think he really was. And we had a great rapport between the two of us. You know, we were great friends, I suppose. Really, we were great friends. And, you know, he knew, and I would adjust anything. He was so malleable and so kind. He never got upset or anything when I changed setups or did anything that I, you know, it was very easy to talk to him and say, well, you know, that's not quite what I want, or that's not quite the look, or whatever. Can we make, oh, yes, and he'd be there in a shot and make it look what I wanted.
That problem has already been solved.
The upcoming scene of Campbell suspended on the mountain was inspired by an actual sight, as John Glenn recalls.
And many others like when I arrived in Murren, there was a fellow swaying on the Eiger. You know, he'd a climber who'd been frozen to death when he was trying to make his ascent, and he'd slipped and fallen, and no one could get to him. It was that inaccessible. And when we arrived, the body was still there, swaying in the wind, high up on the Eiger. And Peter Hunt, I think, was so impressed with this, and he wanted to incorporate this idea of the frozen body in the ice in the Blofeld fortress.
Artist Cliff Cully created the matte painting, which makes the death of Campbell so chilling.
And he's waiting for Bernard Horsfall to come and rescue him, and the villain says, you know, he won't be coming, and this was the shot. Bernard was shot here in the studio, hanging upside down in all his climbing gear, and then the paintings put round it afterwards.
Peter Hunt remembers why George Lazenby was so convincing in his fight scenes.
George was very good at these sort of things because he tended to do them real. He didn't act out his fightings and things like that. He really made a struggle, and they had to hang on to him.
The wheel room scene was filmed at Pinewood Studios in late January, at the same time as the scenes in Ruby's room. The set was again aided by a painting from Matt artist Cliff Cully, as Peter Hunt recalls.
There's a painted mat by Cliff Cully of the bottom, making it so deep. And I also put in there that he kicks a metal fire, or, I don't know, screwdriver, so that you hear it go down a long, long way before it clangs at the bottom, just to give you the idea, just to emphasize the point. But it was done as it was written, if you look in the script, I think it was written in one paragraph, in a very sort of throwaway line. And the rest of it was devised by the art department and how I would shoot it. And between the two of us, we got the easiest way to shoot it and the best result that we could get. So it was a typical art department film director coordination.
Again, the royal color purple appears in the wrapping paper on the girl's presents. George Lazenby's stand-in for the wheel room scene was Roy Everson. Everson later served as Sean Connery's stand-in for Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. In this scene, we see James Bond, for the first time since From Russia with Love, stripped down to nothing but his ingenuity. There are no gadgets from Q to rescue him from this situation. Peter Hunt talks about the scene and its Hitchcockian overtones.
you know, we're repeating, as you said, Hitchcockian type things here, you know, just usual.
The work of mad artists enhanced several Bond films through the years, and it is effectively used in many key scenes of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Director Peter Hunt.
That's a Cliff Carley painted mat. That's a typical instance of a painted mat which gives me my depth. The worst thing to try and shoot is depth, I'm afraid. Unless you have a car down there or something that's identifiable, it's very difficult to get a depth out of anything without hanging on to it or being obvious about it.
Unusual problems call for creative solutions, and a creative solution was found, which allowed camera operator Alec Mills to get a tracking shot of George Lazenby hanging from a cable in the wheel room scene, as Michael Reed recalls.
The sequence we shot when Bond's trying to escape via the wheelhouse of the cable car, we had to use, because we couldn't get any tracking boards or the tracking equipment into the small area that he was shooting. So I think the art department and John Steers, they made up some form of ballet gear that they hung Alec Mills on the actual wire itself. So in other words, when the wheelhouse started and the wheel in the wheelhouse started to rotate, he was pulled along on this cable. So it gave us a very good tracking shot.
Casting director Dyson Lovell had his hands full finding 12 women to be Peas Gloria allergy patients. Peter Hunt recalls the approach they took in selecting those girls.
My intention was nothing to do other than just different nationalities. Young girls who were attractive, and I wanted actresses. I didn't want anybody's girlfriend or that sort of thing. I wanted definite actresses, and I wanted attractive girls. And we looked and looked and looked. You must remember, I had a casting director as well, whom I was working with, so that I could get the best people and see all those that were available.
Veteran stuntman Richard Graydon worked on many Bond films. Later in this sequence, he doubles George Lazenby in the exterior shots of the escape scenes. These were filmed in a snowstorm on location at the Shiltorn Bond, while the cables were icing over. But Graydon wasn't George Leach's first choice for the job, as he recalls.
There was one scene when he had to go hand over hand along a cable, and George Leach had chosen another stuntman who was taller than me to double George Lazenby, but unfortunately, he just wasn't up to the job when it came to it. And he asked to go home, which suited me very nicely, because cable work and high work is rather my speciality. So when this stuntman, who in fact had what you might call bottled out of it, went home, I remained, did the job, and received a reward for it.
Peter Hunt builds the suspense with insert shots.
All separate shots, inserts that I did. Boy, I'm a master at inserts. I've done so many of them in my career. But that's what built the suspense. I hope there was some suspense. I had a big problem, which we cheated over there, as you see, a cutting cheat, of him actually dropping on top. Unless you start to analyze it, you don't notice. Dramatically, he falls, and he's done very good.
When weather delays began forcing the picture behind schedule, Peter Hunt turned to an old colleague to come in as second unit director. It was a fortuitous moment for John Glenn, who would also edit the picture and eventually go on to direct 5 James Bond movies on his own. John Glenn recalls how his lucky break came about.
Well, I started in the industry as a boy, as an office boy at Chapman Studios, working for Sir Alexander Corder. And strangely enough, it was at that time that another junior assistant was Peter Hunt, who directed On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And I used to go into his cutting room and collect the waste film and put it in sacks and take it away and what have you. And we struck up a friendship which lasted for many, many years. and culminated in my being film editor and second unit director on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which Peter directed after doing a wonderful job on the early Bond films as the film editor.
John Glenn's work on the second unit ski action helped provide the film with some of its most memorable sequences. It also helped put the film back on schedule. Director Peter Hunt recalls how he convinced the producers to hire John Glenn.
He was came into the studio to see what was going on. And I talked to him. I said, "What are you doing, John?" And he said, "I'm not doing anything." So I said, "Here, I want to talk to you. I'd like you to do some second unit stuff for me on this film I'm doing." And I took him over to Cubby, I think it was, Cubby and Harry, and said, "Look, I really think that this man, John Glenn, should do our second unit. He's very good, and I know him, and he's worked with, and we ought to, you know, put him on to do the odd bits and pieces that I need, and chases, things like that." And that's how that came about. And he was put on as the second unit director. And, of course, was, you know, as we worked together a lot, he was terrific. For me, he was fine. And for them, too, you know, I mean, he shot a great deal of bits and pieces, like I used to on when I was editing the earlier Bonds, you know, I mean, all sorts of things that were necessary in shooting with the ski run, you know, the bobsleigh run and that type of thing, which were very important.
Here we see the craft of the screenwriter and director. Bond has now heard and seen all he needs to know of Blofeld's plot, but he still has to escape Peace Gloria. As he eases down the stairs, the director is already setting up elements that will come into play at the finale.
I wanted to show those things on the wall, those spikes, and that's how I did it. Again, this is another made-up bit that I made up just to get rid of the guy at the desk. Seemed to me too obvious that he would come down in the lift and there would be nobody there when we'd seen somebody there, so I figured on doing this bit of nonsense, which gave us a bit of excitement. Figure of covering a fight is to give yourself as much material as you can, and plenty of it, so that, in fact, fights are always made in the cutting rooms.
Dick Armstrong, who later became second unit director on Bond films, recalls how he came to be hired on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
It just shows what fate's all about. I had a farm in near the Pinewood Studios, and I wasn't living there at the time. I'd bought a house up the road, and I went in to see my father. We kept our horses there, obviously, and he trained them. And as I walked in, the phone was ringing, so I answered it, and they said, "Oh, is Vic Armstrong?" And I said, "Yeah, it's me." "Okay, right, are you available for 2 weeks? I said, yeah. And they said, "Well, we'll get back to you, you know, this evening." So I put the phone down, didn't know what it was or anything. So they called back that evening and said, "Yeah, you're on a 2 o'clock flight tomorrow afternoon." And I said, "What is it and where is it?" And they said, "Oh, it's Bond and you're going to Switzerland." And I went, oh, great. I was totally amazed. But it made me think then, if I hadn't answered the phone, you know, they'd have gone from the A Armstrong down to B for somebody else and, you know, wouldn't have got it. And it was like 4 months' work, doubling Lazenby, and, you know, a good kudos for me as an up-and-coming stuntman. So we got out there and the first thing they said was, "Do you ski?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Well, I'm afraid, you know, you're probably going to have to learn to ski."
The most exciting passage of Fleming's novel is Bond's escape on skis from Blofeld's fortress. In his youth, while at school in Kitzbühel, Austria and Geneva, Switzerland, Fleming became a skilled skier. To help bring the ski scenes to life on the big screen, the filmmakers turned to German Olympic skiing champion Willy Bogner, as John Glenn recalls.
I first met Willy on Her Majesty's Secret Service. He was one of several cameramen that were actually in place when I arrived. And he wasn't really used very much. And in fact, I had a lot of people that sort of blew down my ear as soon as I arrived in Switzerland. And Willie was one of them. And he said, "I can do wonderful things with a camera. I can ski forwards, I can ski backwards, I can ski through trees and up into trees, and I can do all this sort of stuff." And I listened to a lot of people, and I listened to him. So what I did was I sent him off with a few guards in the right uniform to do traveling shots, you know, and exciting shots and what have you. And he came back and I looked at the rushes, and they were the most exciting things I'd ever seen on film. I mean, he was there with the action, and he had that wonderful ability. I think he was an Olympic skier at one time. And he had points on either end of his skis, so he could turn round, he could shoot through his legs, so you could be following someone, or you could be in front of someone shooting through his legs backwards, you see. And he could do anything the skiers could do. He was remarkable. We shot it at various times. Sometimes you use the magic, what we call the magic hour. That's just the half an hour you get between sunlight and moonlight. And that's a good time. We milk that every night. We would be there to do that, and we do the wider shots in that sort of light. And then we'd gradually go into night work, where we would have lights, and in some instances we use flares. Yeah, just use the huge, I'm not sure what they're called, but they're like these big candle flares, and we'd stick them up on poles, dozens of them, and light them up and by electric means, and that would illuminate the mountainside. And of course, with the snow, reflects a lot of light, so it was very effective.
Stuntman Richard Graydon was very impressed by Willy Bogner's skill on the slopes.
I did work with Willy Bogner on Her Majesty's Secret Service, but I'm not a skier, or rather I'm a very moderate skier, and I wouldn't dream of getting involved in the expert skiing scenes on Her Majesty's Secret Service that Willy Bogner organized. He used local expert skiers and not stuntmen for the scenes on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Doubling for George Lazenby, stuntman Vic Armstrong had to take a heart-pounding tumble.
My job was, we had 3 foot of snow on this 1,500-foot edge. We couldn't walk onto it because we wanted the virgin snow effect, so we'd throw the cables out and measure them and everything else and tie them on your leg. That's all it was. And I just got back about 30 feet behind camera, took a run and dove over the camera and just slid over the edge. But the worst thing was, because there's about 3 foot of snow on the edge, as I went over, it created a little avalanche. So I, in fact, went 3 foot further than we'd figured. We hadn't allowed for this snow on the edge, so it made the heart rate go up a little bit.
Willy Bogner came to the attention of Cubby Broccoli after making a 47-minute documentary that won prizes at film festivals in Cortina d'Ampezzo and Grenoble. After receiving the call from Broccoli, Bogner joined the film unit in Switzerland, as he recalls.
And I had made a film, Ski Fascination, a couple of years ago, before that phone call. And we experimented quite a lot with different camera techniques. Just skiing with the camera in your hands at high speeds, like in a downhill race around 60, 70 miles an hour. Because I wanted to get the feeling over to the public how it is to be on the race course yourself, and that obviously to just take the camera with you is a good idea, and it worked amazingly well without a lot of rigs, just holding the camera free in your hands and absorbing the bumps and all of the speed with your legs, because like on skis you're like on a dolly. You're not walking, you don't have movement like this, you're gliding. Obviously then with jumping and things like that, you have to make the movement smoother. So we just went out there and did a lot of experimenting, and we developed this technique to a level in 35mm cinemascope, or Panavision as Bond was shooting then, that it was actually working also on a professional level.
After Honor Majesty's Secret Service, Bogner went on to work on 3 other James Bond films, The Spy Who Loved Me, For Your Eyes Only, and A View to a Kill. The upcoming scene, a fight in a barn filled with bells, was on the call sheet for many weeks before finally being shot. It was used as a cover set, a scene that could be shot when foul weather prevented the unit from shooting exteriors. Peter Hunt remembers.
When we were on location hunting, we were looking around, and we went into some farmhouse, rather, we were looking for whatever it was. And I opened this door, and there, absolutely immaculately, were these rows of cowbells, from little ones to big ones. They all went in sizes, and they were all polished. There were 2 whole rows of them hanging on this thing. And I was with Dick Mandel, and I said to him, Dick, I've got the most marvellous idea. There must be a fight in here. Just imagine the noise. Just imagine that. And I swung the bell, and it went, song, ing. And I said, we've got to, somewhere, we've got to have a fight in the bell room.
Director of photography Michael Reed recalls the scene.
When we shot the cow shed, which was known as the bell sequence, very limited for space. I had to use mainly the small inky dinkies to light it, so because we couldn't get any heavy lamps in there at all. And the bells themselves, I mean, wherever they got them from, they were the original cow bells. And George, again, made great use of them, I think, in that.
Had it not been for a premonition on the part of director Peter Hunt, the scene at the ice rink might never have come off at all, as Michael Reed remembers.
And Peter came in and said to me, I want to shoot tonight. So I said, well, it's going to be tough getting everything in. He said, I don't care. He said, I want to shoot tonight. So I said, all right. So he said, I want to shoot on the ice rink, because he said, I've got a feeling about it. So I said, fine. We set up the brute for the main follow spot. And the rest we filled in with filler light. And we shot the long shots and some shots with Dyna rig. And it all worked out extremely well. The following night we had to repeat this going into the crowd. And the following morning I woke up, and it had had a big thaw overnight, and there was very little ice left on the rink. On top of which, the sequence we had of them arriving by car through there was no snow on the ground. So during the day, they were having to ship lorry loads of snow from higher up the mountain down and spreading across the road. And if Peter Hunt hadn't shot that night, I don't think we'd have ever got the long shots.
Since Diana Rigg did not know how to ice skate, she had a double perform her skating. These scenes, requiring a crowd of 750 extras, were shot in Grindelwald, a location that was like a holiday for the filmmakers, as Alec Mills recalls.
After Christmas, we went back again. This time we went to Grindelwald. Now, Grindelwald, this was rather different. It was more exciting. And I think the reason for it, nothing to do with the filming, but we went back to do a sequence of a car crash in a car race or something, and the cars get tangled up. It was a wonderful sequence, which is a second unit shot, and we were doing the close shots in the main unit and picking up shots and things like that. They worked out fine. But it was a very exciting period, too, because après-ski, the hours were rather different, because the sequence we were shooting was night. And what it would be that we'd start shooting probably around about doing our work about 5 o'clock in the evening when it started to get dark, but we'd be finished by about midnight. And of course, that's the time for all the skiers to, when life in Grindelwald or any of these places, après ski, it just bursts into life, and we joined in, because the next morning we didn't have to go to work. We could lay down and sleep in bed till about 12, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. And we had the most wonderful holiday as well as filming. It was the most exciting time, and it's one of those locations which you always remember and think, oh God, it was wonderful, you know. I loved it. Loved every minute of it.
Director of photography Michael Reed remembers shooting close-ups of George Lazenby and Diana Rigg inside Tracy's Cougar.
We did a lot of the interiors on Diana and George in the car. Again, there were certain things in it that Peter Hunt couldn't shoot live. There were certain things in where she had to concentrate either on the driving or on the dialogue, you see. So a lot of that was brought, or some of it anyway, was brought into the studio.
Robin Brown worked on Her Majesty's Secret Service on the aerial photography unit. He remembers the difficulties caused by the mild winter when it came to shooting the film's ski sequences and other winter action. He also recalls the Bond team were not the only filmmakers shooting in the Swiss Alps in the winter of 1968 and 69.
The biggest holdup was the fact that we had no virgin snow for a very long time. They even talked about going across to Wengen, which was the other side of the main valley, which was another ski resort. But that was pretty busy with, at that time, Robert Redford was making Downhill Racer. There was another unit across the way. But as far as I remember, I mean, sounds like a terrible excuse, but it's 30 years ago that we did on Her Majesty's Secret Service. And I think everything went pretty smoothly, pretty well. I think the weather was our biggest hold-up of it that we had. And, of course, the other problem when you do a long ski run is the turnaround time to get the skiers to pick them up, take them back and put them up. You probably, if you were lucky, you'd get one run in the morning and then one run in the afternoon. It was a very, very slow process. Very slow indeed.
The post office phone booth sequence, which we've just seen, was filmed on March 6, 1969, at the Jungfrau Hotel in Lauterbrunnen. Exterior shots of the car chase were filmed the following weeks near Stetchelberg, with stunt driver Maurice Grove driving Tracy's Cougar. Director Peter Hunt recalls how he came up with the idea for the stock car sequence.
The idea came because we saw a stunt unit doing this in Switzerland as a sort of, you know, fate or whatever it was on one of the one of our recces, I think the year before, and that's where it came from. Because we saw this stunt group doing it and said, wouldn't it be great if we could use that as a deviation in the car chase, you know, which we could. And we used, and we hired the same stunt group people to do it. And we had to ice the whole of that rink, special rink, in order to be able to do it.
Before the scene could be shot, production designer Sid Kane had to create a stock car stadium in an icy racetrack in Lauterbrunnen, as he explains.
That was a playing field at one time, and we flooded that with water nightly and gradually froze it until we literally got an ice rink there, and then built the stands and everything else. You know, we'd play that sequence there on a field, a flat field. That was done by my art director, Bob Lang.
I hope my big end will stand up to this.
Stunt driver Reg Harding was at the wheel of Irma Bunt's Mercedes. One of the passengers was stuntman Richard Graydon, who recalls the scene.
The ice rink was very exciting. And that was shot at night. And it was meant to be a motor race on the ice. As far as I remember, we had steel knobs nailed in the tyres, studs, I think you'd better call them, to give us a grip. But that, of course, we couldn't skid with those steel studs in the tyres because it ruined the ice for the skaters. So they had to be taken off, which meant to say you were virtually out of control most of the time you were doing the skidding work. I was in a car that had to turn over up a small ramp and turn over upside down. But the ramp stuff worked very well. The car flipped over, and no damage was done. There was reinforcement under the roof. And I think it was an effective sequence. It was very cold at night, but we had big heaters blowing hot air all over us, which, of course, sometimes melted the top surface of the ice.
Since movies are filmed out of sequence, on Her Majesty's Secret Service required two Cougars for Tracy, one undamaged for scenes that take place before the stock car rally, and one damaged for scenes that take place afterwards. On March 1st of 1969, the damaged Cougar was transported to a barn at Farm Kampf for shots of Tracy and Bond's arrival. Special effects snow machines added to the atmosphere of the sequence. Director Peter Hunt recalls shooting the love scene between Bond and Tracy.
And it was a very nice barn we found, so that was easy to get, and the snow was coming down. That was easy enough to shoot. We shot the outside of it on location, I might tell you, for real, and then pushed it in, and then we went inside for the cane set, you know, of the interior of the barn. And I felt that, you know, we should make it. I wanted it really to be romantic but charming, with a slight sense of humour. Not easy, but that's what we got. And that's how the scene eventually came out. That was why it was so... It was a nice little scene. We wanted to make it look real, and like so many things that you want some emotion out of, and you have a delicate scene, you know, a proposal scene like that with her, and the blizzard blowing outside, and they just escaped from the enemy, and it was not suddenly you were going to change the whole atmosphere of the film.
The shots of Bond and Tracy inside the barn are some of the most captivating images in the entire James Bond series, thanks to the expertise of cinematographer Michael Reed. Reed remembers filming the scene.
Shooting the love scene in the barn, which is the first real emotional, physical side of the tie between George Lazenby and Diana. We shot that with using a diffusion on her to soften the whole sequence. We used the cobweb machine to a great degree, and we used a tracking shot, a very, very slow tracking shot with foreground going between the two.
Tracy?
So that at the beginning they were being separated, and then gradually we came closer and closer in until the final kiss at the end.
The scene marks a dramatic change of pace from the skiing and stock car action which precedes it, and the second ski chase which will soon follow. But in the practiced hands of Peter Hunt, the transitions are skillfully handled.
It was very important to change the scene from this high drama of the chase and all the elements there, as you say, of this car getting muddied up and the engine stopping and the petrol running out and, you know, the usual cliche things, but not to make them look cliche, not to make them, to make it all very believable, at the same time make it romantic. And that's what I really strove for within the film. I can't tell you in detail, I can just tell you I know how to do it, or I thought I knew how to do it. And when it's done, you look at it and see whether your thoughts about doing it are right. And if they're not, you're in trouble, and you better get yourself out of trouble. And if they are all right, you're very pleased with yourself. You say, that worked very well.
While working as an editor on the early Bond films, Peter Hunt had collaborated closely with director Terence Young. He brought lessons he learned from Young into On Her Majesty's Secret Service, as he recalls.
I tried to make everything have some sort of purpose, and I like the scenes to flow so that they are very natural in any way that they can. That's what I try and achieve. I had great luck to be given enormous opportunities with Terence and learn a great deal at his feet, as it were. And I'd been associated with a lot of other big pictures as an editor, so I wasn't really green to coming to, you know, be a director. It was a fulfillment of an ambition, of course. I wanted to be always a director, but I had a lot of probably experience, which gave me an advantage over maybe somebody coming in doing it for the first time. So it wasn't quite really the first time that I had controlled a set and developed a scene.
The amazing aerial footage came courtesy of Johnny Jordan. Peter Hunt remembers the cameraman.
Oh, yes, lovely Johnny Jordan. We worked a lot together. Again, we see how marvelous it is when you know the people you're working with. He was great on this. He was really a master at it. I wanted to have some very beautiful shots from the helicopter. I think we must have talked about what they were and how they went and that sort of thing. And he and John Crudson, who was the pilot of the helicopter, had worked out this whole idea of having him hanging from underneath the helicopter on a harness.
And because they felt, and certainly Johnny Jordan was so enthusiastic, that that way he could do a complete shot and he could go up and down without the restrictions of just shooting outside, out of the one side of a helicopter. And that is in fact what they did do. And it was really quite fantastic. It's been written about a great deal, but it was quite fantastic, this hanging harness underneath the helicopter with Johnny Jordan. It's cold, of course. He used to have to dress up very warm. And he shot most of the, in fact, shot all the aerial skiing stuff.
The device of the man skiing into the snowplow appears in Fleming's novel, Peter Hunt recalls.
Well, we nearly lost this, unfortunately, and the second unit got it for me. But I think it's the end of a chapter in Fleming's book which particularly impressed me when I first read it. And the chapter ends with, "And the snow slowly turned pink."
Diana Rigg's double for the ski scenes and the avalanche scene was Ursula Otten. Dick Armstrong doubled for George Lazenby in certain avalanche shots. The avalanche was created by editing together footage of a real avalanche shot by second unit director John Glenn, a miniature avalanche created by John Steers using salt in place of snow, close-up shots done in the studio with a turnover mount on the camera, and optical work by Cliff Cully, painting in the teeny figures of Bond and Tracy skiing away from the cascading snow. Peter Hunt recalls how his original plans for the scene were thwarted.
We scouted this location, of course, and found it the winter before we were going to shoot. And we talked with, because we had planned for an avalanche in the film, and that was going to be one of the big action pieces. And so the Swiss Army said, we plant in the summer the explosions, and when the snow has all come in there, and it's ready, we blow it for you. You tell us when you want it and we'll blow it for you. We'll tell you when it's ready. And it all seemed like it was a well-organized thing. And of course the Swiss are very, as you will see, the Swiss are very nervous about avalanches and starting them, but as long as they're under the control of the army and the officials, it's okay, you know. Well, sure enough, when we got there and we were shooting, I used to come out of my chalet in the morning, look up and see all this wonderful snow hanging over. I'd go into the office, the production office, and say, when are we going to shoot that avalanche? That snow looks jolly good. Oh, don't worry, we'll tell you. The army will tell us when the time is right and we'll schedule it. I used to do this morning after morning. And one morning, of course, I got up, looked up there as I was leaving my chalet. No snow. It had all gone in the night. No avalanche. Nothing. Oh, well, they said, there you are, it's one of those things. Well, I said, what are we going to do? We've got to have an avalanche. He said, I think Cubby or somebody said, well, it doesn't matter. Maybe we'll cut it out. Maybe. No way. We're going to have an avalanche. And apart from a few shots that I was able to pick up, as you'll have seen in that sequence, the rest of that avalanche is made up of library material and close shots of them rolling around in fake snow in the insert stage of studio and sound.
The effective and subtle device of the flashback on the window pane marks the first time a flashback was used in a James Bond film. After editing the first four 007 films, as well as shooting insert material and doing some second unit directing, Peter Hunt had originally wanted to direct You Only Live Twice, but that assignment was given to Lewis Gilbert. Disappointed, Hunt walked away from the series, but as he explains, he didn't stay away for long.
In truth, I wanted to do it, and they knew I wanted to do it. And there was, a certain amount of animosity on my part that they didn't give me the next Bond film to do. And after Thunderball, I left them and went on a long holiday. I went around the world.
which they were very generous to me about and paid for the whole trip. But, funnily enough, of course, I ran into Cubby and Lewis Gilbert in Tokyo, which I was visiting for a holiday. And, cut a long story short, I must say, Cubby kept saying to me, why don't you come and do the second unit, and we'll give you the next one.
So, if we destroy the center, much of the crew on the Bond films remained constant from one movie to the next, which gave Peter Hunt a measure of comfort as he set to direct on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
The producers were very clever. They got a unit around them, which happened to work very well with the first one, and they carried on with that unit. They carried on a sort of loyalty with that unit, probably for the first five or six, I think. It only began to break up after that period of time. And it was always a happy unit. It was always extremely happy, basically because everybody knew what they were doing, and both the producers left you to do your job. And they were very supportive of you in everything that you did, everything you wanted to do.
Peter Hunt explains the importance of keeping up the momentum in the last act of the film.
Now we're into the, you know, the sort of end of the story. So you've got very little time, and you mustn't construct your film so that you slow it down here. That would be, you've got to move your film on. Now you've got to excite your audience, keep them going. You're getting near the bus stop, as it were. You know, you're getting there.
Although Richard Maybaum was the screenwriter of On Her Majesty's Secret Service, novelist Simon Raven was brought in to polish the dialogue between Blofeld and Tracy and the dialogue of Sir Hilary Bray. Simon Raven explains how he came to be part of the 007 creative team.
I came to be mixed up with Her Majesty's Secret Service. I'm not quite sure. Possibly because I used to review quite a lot of Bond novels for things like The Listener, Spectator. Possibly because I had a small name for having written one or two radio and television plays, which contained a certain amount of action. Anyway, my name was picked up and I was set to write some dialogue, specimen dialogue. And I think what I wrote got me the job. I'd never known Peter Hunt before. Working with Peter, mind you, I was only the word man. I wasn't on screen, on set, or anything like that. It was a joy. He knew what he wanted. He explained what he wanted, clearly in words of three syllables, not just one, three syllables. And you went away and did it and brought it back. If it was good, he said so. If it wasn't, he said so. And you went away and did it again, which is exactly, of course, what should happen. But always he made it absolutely clear what he wanted and why. I say again,
land at Zurich and report. Simon Raven explains why he feels the James Bond novels of Ian Fleming should be judged not as just works of popular fiction, but they should be looked upon as literature.
Fleming's novels, as I say, I'd reviewed a number of them over the years, and I genuinely enjoyed them. I thought that Casino Royale was quite differently a work of literature. See, Fleming wasn't simply a thriller writer, though he's very good at that. He was quite a powerful moralist when he wanted to be. This is part of him people neglect, and probably didn't get too big a showing in the Bond films. So every now and again there would be a passage. But I admired Fleming the Robin, the moralist. And I knew him very slightly because I'd played golf with him on one occasion. He used to come to my part of the world to play golf at St. George's. And on one occasion I actually played with him. I also met him at a spectator party from time to time. So that was more my world, which is a spectator than and writing my own novels than read either film or television.
As a book reviewer for the British newspaper The Listener, Simon Raven gave Ian Fleming's debut novel Casino Royale a good review, praising it as, quote, a good story with strength and distinction, unquote, but dismissing what he felt was a clumsy ending and a monstrous torture scene. As more James Bond novels appeared, however, Simon Raven's appreciation for them grew. Raven was himself author of the bestsellers Feathers of Death and the Alms for Oblivion series of novels, including Field and Gray. He adapted books for the BBC by such writers as Aldous Huxley, Somerset Maugham, and Anthony Trollope. In 1981, he provided the script for the 8-part British series Love in a Cold Climate, adapted from the book by Nancy Mitford and featuring Judi Dench, who would go on to play M. His other teleplays include the miniseries Edward and Mrs. Simpson and The Pallisers. Peter Hunt had a simple reason for hiring Simon Raven.
I wanted him because I'd always liked his novels, and I thought he would give the film perhaps a bit of something.
Diana Rigg spent the early part of her life in India, where her father was in government service. A veteran of the Royal Shakespeare Company, Rigg had no problem delivering the poem Tracy quotes to divert Blofeld's attention from the approaching helicopters. Simon Raven recalls finding the poem.
The poem quoted by Tracy, "Thy dawn, O master of the world, thy dawn," it's by James Elroy Flecker, and it comes in a long and rather improbable play called Hassan, which I'd been rereading by chance a few weeks before. And it suddenly occurred to me, if Harry would go for it, which he did, and Peter Hunt would go for it, which he did, that this might sort of make a dramatic change in rhythm at this particular juncture. And so I put it up, and they accepted it, most of the poem anyway.
The attack on Peace Gloria presented a number of challenges to the stunt crew of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Stuntman Richard Graydon remembers just how dangerous some of the stunts proved to be.
It was helicopter stuff, leaping out of helicopters into deep snow, and one was never quite sure how deep the snow was. Sometimes one found herself almost disappearing in the snow when you jumped from a helicopter. And the other occasion, I was very nearly injured when I found that underneath the snow, there was a rock surface. When you're jumping onto snow, it's not always possible to guarantee that the snow is precisely as you would wish. So I think the helicopter stuff jumping out of the plane on Her Majesty's Secret Service was the hazardous part of that film.
Tracy's fight with Gunther, played by Russian wrestler Yuri Borienko, allowed Diana Rigg to show off some of the fighting skills she had learned on the television series The Avengers. Rigg joined the series in 1965, filling the void created when Honor Blackman left to star in Goldfinger. Rigg stayed with the series until the end of the 1968 season, when she left to pursue a film career. She made one film before On Her Majesty's Secret Service, The Assassination Bureau. Peter Hunt remembers an inspiration he had for the assault on Blofeld's mountain fortress.
Then I got the idea that he should slide all the way up, firing his gun, because I thought it would look good. And not only that, it was quite exciting. I just thought of that on the spur of the moment, you know, when we were up there shooting with everything. And bringing over the helicopters and them hovering in the... And we were very lucky with the up inside the helicopter, you know, with the sun going down and the sky and the three helicopters coming on. It looked very dramatic and was very suspenseful, I think.
Before finding Peace Gloria, a number of locations were under consideration. Production designer Sid Kane recalls location scouting with producer Harry Saltzman.
On His Majesty's Secret Service, he said to me, I've got just the place for Blofeld headquarters. I said, fine. He said, I want you to come out with me. He said, and we go to the Maginot Line in France. Now, not many people now know what the Maginot Line was, but it was a line of defense built by the French to stop the Germans. And the guns are calibrated so that... the shells fell just short of the border. That was it, purely defence. We go in the Maginot Line, and we're sitting in this little train, and we've got a guide, and they'd open the whole of the Maginot Line just for Harry and me, well, for Harry. And we're going along this, like, tunnel, which is rather like the underground in England.
And they took us down to the dining rooms and the morgue and so on, up into the gun turrets. It was quite interesting, wonderful. And Harry said, what do you think? I said, well, I could build this in Pinewood, Harry. You know, with a bit of force perspective, I can give you all this. And he swore and immediately turned, and we turned and came back. And he then took me, and we drove like mad to Paris and then drove to Switzerland. And he took me to another place, his second line of what's that? And it was like a gun emplacement on top of this mountain, you see. And I said, Harry, we're very limited to what we can shoot here. I mean, he says, you know, even if we get permission. Because these guns used to sort of pop out the mountainside and go back again, you know. And he swore again and said, find it yourself. Which I did. And I went to Murren and found Blofeld's place there.
The final shots of Blofeld's fortress exploding and then imploding were achieved through the talents of special effects man John Steers, as Peter Hunt recalls.
And the final blow up, the final thing, when we're in the helicopter and we look down and we see is a model, I'm afraid. And that was very good. It was a beautifully made model and it flew beautifully.
Special effects man John Steers remembers the explosion.
We did have to demolish the lair where the villain was, which is the Schilthorn barn above Murren. That's 12,000 feet up in the Alps. Well, what we did, I actually used some very lightweight charges up there because we weren't allowed to make any big explosions up there. And when I came back to Pinewood, I built a miniature of the whole thing and destroyed the miniature.
An impressive shot is the ice bridge crumbling beneath the feet of Blofeld as he dashes across it. Director Peter Hunt recalls.
Just had to crumble under the feet. It had to look like it was a big ravine where there was just this ice bridge over it, and as he ran across it, it went. Unfortunately, there was no second take.
John Glenn remembers shooting the Bob Run sequence.
We used World Championship Bob men from the Swiss national team, and there was a chap that was our advisor, was a guy called Franz Capus, who used to go down the run every morning in a little child's sledge and check that everything was safe, there weren't pieces of wood and obstructions in the, or worst of all, anybody in the run, because these four men Bobs would come down at 60 miles an hour and turn a corner, and if someone was in the run, they'd had it, you know. And on one occasion, Franz, in his enthusiasm, went down to check something and didn't tell anyone. And we sent off a four-man Bob down the run. And there, lo and behold, they turned the corner, and there was Franz in the run on his little... Johnny Jordan was in the nose of the Bob, filming for a plate, actually, for a front projection plate. And as he came around the corner, we have it on film, Franz Capuzzi's horrified look as he turned around and saw this four-man Bob thundering towards him at 60 miles an hour. The driver of the Bob run did the impossible. He managed to actually steer the Bob up the wall, up the square wall, you know, and he hit Franz Capuzzi a glancing blow. But when we picked up Franz by helicopter and took him to hospital where he was very badly bruised, this man was like 78 years of age, I think. And all he was worried about was the loss of his hat, which finished up on top of a pine tree.
Luckily, no one was seriously injured on the Bob run. Johnny Jordan, who filmed the entire mishap from the front of the Bob, made a souvenir afterwards to commemorate the event for Franz Capus, as Robin Brown recalls.
And John filmed the whole thing. And then he insisted on getting Technicon to send a print to us, especially of this remarkable piece of film. And then John went to the local photographers and he said, I want a still of every one of these frames. And he made a flicker book for this old guy. And this old boy would sit in the bar with his flicker book, and it's just illustrating how lucky he was.
Transmitting the Bob Run sequence to film required weeks of shooting, with two doubles for James Bond, two doubles for Blofeld, and George Leach filling in from time to time. Sometimes capturing even the simplest scenes can prove difficult, as John Glenn recalls about the upcoming sequence with the St. Bernard.
We ran out of light, and I had George Lazenby only for an hour or two at the end of the day. So we put George Lazenby and the dog and the handler in the helicopter, and we flew to the other side of the mountain where we had light for another hour and a half. So I said to George, be prepared with this animal to do anything. We don't know what he's going to do. The trainer's been trying to sort of teach him, but he's likely as not, he'll do nothing. But be prepared. Whatever happens, go along with it. And on take one, the light going down, we had about 5 minutes of light left. On take one, the dog came in, went up to George, rolled over on its back and started shaking itself in the snow. And George said, never mind about that, go and fetch the brandy. And he just improvised it, you know, and another person would have probably burst out laughing because it wasn't what they expected the dog to do at all. But you never know what they're going to do.
The wedding ring, which James Bond gives to Tracy, was reproduced for sale in Britain, inscribed with the words, "All the time in the world." The ring sold for 10 shillings. Director Peter Hunt.
It says we have all the time in the world on it. Unfortunately, I didn't have... This is a reason, you know, where you don't get the time to put anything in within the scene. I didn't have any point at which I could put the entire ring in and show what was inside it and you know, really show how beautifully it was made.
Draco's home was filmed at the famed Vinhaus Estate in Portugal in May 1969. Bond and Tracy's wedding was shot at the end of the production schedule. Indeed, the five-day wedding scene shoot was immediately followed by 6 days of filming Marc-Ange Draco's birthday party. The motif of flowers, which began with Tracy and Bond in the hotel at the beginning of the film, continues now at the climax. Peter Hunt.
Here again come all the flowers.
Set dresser Peter Lamont remembers the director's instructions.
I remember that we, a friend of ours, who was helping us on the production, he came and said, well, you know, there was a caterer in town who did the Patino wedding. So he came along and showed us everything that he'd done. And there was all these magnificent flowers, I can't tell you. And he introduced this fella called Ramiro. And I told him what we wanted. And we started to get the whole set ready. And the caterers actually... spoke to the owners out there, and they actually came into one of the garages and actually did all the cooking out there on the spot. And the florist came out and had all these steaks put in. There were these huge festoons and great bunches of pampas grass, you know, like great plumes on top of every post. It looked pretty spectacular. I can't tell you that night it rained. I can't tell you the next morning I went there, everything looked so sad. Fortunately, all the tables had all been covered with umbrellas by the caterer. Everything was cooking along, you know, there was salmon and all this wonderful spread. And I remember he said, well, I, you know, don't worry about the flowers, because we can put that right, because once the weather comes, we can it'll just blow away very quickly. And when is this great I suppose almost like a barn, but it was kind of brick built with a great roof on it. I've never ever seen so many flowers in my life. It was just amazing. Anyway, the rain stopped, the sun came out, the wind blew, the great plumes came back looking, and we introduced more flowers into the kind of the big festoons that we had.
On the Arabida Road, 4 kilometers from Setúbal, Peter Hunt filmed the tragic end scene of Her Majesty's Secret Service on May 19th and 20th, 1969. Hunt had carefully scouted the beach roads in Portugal to find just the right location for this crucial scene. Director Peter Hunt.
That's a nice little bit that I put in there with the kids going by in the car. And this, she loves me not. And don't eat it all at once. This was a wonderful location right at the top there. I went off and found, and I hoped you would see it. Well, you do a little, and you see it as they drive up there. It's a very nice location. And still keeping it in my romantic mood, she loves me not.
Sticking close to Fleming's original novel, Peter Hunt ends the film on a tragic note. It was a courageous choice and required real acting skills on the part of George Lazenby. John Barry's score plays an important part. By reprising We Have All the Time in the World, Barry helps one to understand James Bond's loss, but then the music segues into the James Bond theme. As one hears the familiar music, one comes to understand the emotional core of the character of Bond, the tragedies that created the cold, dark interior of the elegant, ruthless secret agent, director Peter Hunt.
Because, as I said, we're making a James Bond film, an Ian Fleming story. And this was not necessarily another James Bond. This was James Bond. We made James Bond films.
I would like to thank all the actors and crew of On Her Majesty's Secret Service who are heard on this audio commentary. Peter Hunt, Angela Sklar, George Baker, Lois Maxwell, Michael Reed, Alec Mills, Peter Lamont, John Glenn, Robin Brown, Willie Bogner, Stanley Sopel, Sid Kane, John Barry, Simon Raven, John Steers, Cliff Cully, Vic Armstrong, Richard Graydon, George Leach, and Fred Wilmington. I would also like to pay tribute to all those who assisted in gathering this material for this commentary. This audio commentary was compiled by Bruce Sively, edited by Lisa Hancock, and produced by Bruce Sively, David Naylor, and John Cork. This is John Cork of the Ian Fleming Foundation. I hope you've enjoyed this audio commentary for On Her Majesty's Secret Service.